For years, we've been hearing dire warnings about the state's unfunded liability, the sum of money it owes the more than 135,000 people who are enrolled in the Employees Retirement System, or ERS. By current estimates, the ERS is some $12 billion short of meeting that unfunded liability, but Tom Williams, its executive director, has a plan, and he's in our studio to tell us about it. Hi, Tom. Thanks for coming in.
Chris, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you. You did indicate that the unfunded liability gets an awful lot of attention. It's about $12.4 billion as we speak. But I think it's a bit overblown in the context that the program's vital importance to the people of this state is the key element of what this program delivers. You mentioned the 135,000 members of the Employees Retirement System. We spend or pay benefits about almost $1.3 billion a year. And this assures our members and their beneficiaries financial security and retirement. This program plays a vital role in sustaining the economy of the state during good times and bad. So the focus is obviously oftentimes on the contributions to the systems, but I want us to understand the other side of that is the benefits that accrue from this system that far outweigh, that are significantly greater than the costs that are incurred.
Well, you know, Tom, as soon as I said that about the $12 billion owed to 135,000 people, the catch is those 135,000 people are not going to need to be paid out all at once, right?
Well, clearly that's the case. You know, this is a long-term program. We've got people in the plan that are at the beginnings of their working lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we've got others who've been receiving benefits for 20 or 30 or more years.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. We pay these benefits out over time. But there is a coming press where we have about 14,000 of our existing active employees who are, in fact, eligible. But we do know, in fact, they won't all retire at once.
Right, right. And meanwhile, you're investing the money.
You're absolutely right. And I think that that allows me to make a critically important point. The contributions are significant. We've just enjoyed a contribution increase that will help us to address the unfunded liability that we've talked about. But few people are aware that 60 to 70% of every dollar that we pay out is derived from the investment earnings. So the investments are a key portion, a key responsibility. It's a key benefit, if you will, allowing us to meet those obligations.
The idea for you running this is to keep those investments giving a robust enough return to stay ahead of the obligations. And you're saying that you're on track to do that.
Yes, and in fact we are, both in the near and the longer term. But it takes a lot of discipline to stay on that track. We recently lowered the assumed investment return assumption. It was a smart move. It reflects current realities. That added, actually, a couple of $1 billion to the unfunded liability. We also
Tom, let me interrupt you.
Sure.
Investment return assumption, what was that term?
It's also referred to oftentimes as the discount rate, the rate at which our liabilities are discounted. But it's the actual earnings that we anticipate we'll receive on average over a long period of time. So, for example, the present assumed investment return is 7%. Mm-hmm. So our target in terms of our portfolio allocation is to achieve that level of return or better. And to the extent we achieve higher returns, we address that unfunded liability more quickly.
That's like profit. It functions as profit going back into reducing your obligation.
That's correct. But, of course, all of our profits are to the benefit of our members,
right,
and paid out as retirement benefits.
Profit's kind of a misnomer. but you know what I'm saying, right?
Oh, indeed I do.
7% is doing pretty well by any investment standard, isn't it?
Well, it's a stretch, but a reasonable one, quite frankly, particularly in the more recent fixed income markets. Rates are very, very low, but correspondingly, the equity markets have been quite robust over the last 5, 8, and 10 years. And we've come off a very good year. I guess, fiscal year 17, June 30th of 17, we had a 13.7% rate of return. So we've done considerably better than the 7%. But, you know, it's difficult to maintain that over the long haul. We're working hard to try to accomplish that, though.
Any investor would be thrilled to get double digit returns on an annual basis, wouldn't they? Doing awfully well.
It's doing wonderfully well, but we're fully aware that markets are volatile, they're cyclical, there's a business cycle that will lower the returns during certain periods ahead. But we've structured our investments in anticipation of these downturns in the market. So we've developed novelly what we call a crisis risk offset that's going to mitigate the downturn and over time allow us to more effectively address that unfunded liability and increase those assets.
Every once in a while, the market goes into a kind of free fall. I mean, there are collapses, you know, every, couple of decades or so. What would happen in that event, you know, something really critical, a crash?
Well, you know, we can look back. We know some of the events that have occurred, 2008, 2009, the great financial crisis.
Right.
And most public pension funds saw a dramatic decline in their assets. And that was for a fairly sustained period. This crisis risk offset that I alluded to, in a sustained down period, actually generates positive returns because we have three components of it. One's called systematic trend following, alternate premia, and principal protection sleeves. And the systematic trend following allows the managers to shift directions, shift investments to reflect those types of investments that do better in these kind of down markets. So what's important to us is to mitigate the downside and take advantage to the extent we can of the upside. The geometric return is going to be greater. The asset accumulation at the end of this process will be significantly higher than if we merely let the assets rise and fall without this mitigation as a result of this crisis risk offset.
That takes where there would seem to take almost day-to-day monitoring of the market, both in terms of short and long-term trends. Yeah?
Well, no question about it. Our focus is long-term, but, you know, with the level of data and the complexities of the markets, yes, we're observing market movements on a day-by-day, if not hour-by-hour basis. There's an awful lot of data that's available to us that informs the decisions that we make and our managers make. So it takes really dedicated professional investment people to optimize the return from these kinds of investments.
I would imagine that there are people listening who would say, 13%, how can I do that, right?
Well,
an individual could do the same thing if they did it right.
They could perhaps, but it probably result in significantly more risk. We've got an incredibly highly diversified investment portfolio.
Uh-huh.
It's actually globally invested, and we are able to invest in institutional quality instruments that aren't available, quite frankly, to individuals. So can an individual achieve an equal or higher return? Perhaps, but on a small basis, not with a $16, $17 billion portfolio such as we administer.
The things you just described as being available only to organizations like yourself, is that because you have so much money to invest?
It's largely the level of assets that we have available to invest.
Right.
It's also the level of knowledge that we have as an investor. So some of these investments would be inappropriate for the individual investor because you wouldn't understand in detail the relative risk and the corresponding rewards. And so there are Securities and Exchange Commission regulations that limit what individuals are focused in terms of offerings as compared to institutional investors.
The whole complexity of this arrangement is a challenge for you, I would imagine, to communicate to your members.
Well, what we want our members to know is that these are the retirement fund is a complicated, sophisticated organization. I like to think of it as having multiple dimensions. It's like a big investment bank. It's also an education institution. We're a technology organization. We're a data house. We're a service provider. All of these elements have to be first in class in order for us to deliver on our commitments and the level of service that we owe to our members.
Tom, what's your timeline for meeting the unfunded liability?
Well, let me just say that the legislature has imposed a 30-year time frame. That's generally accepted in the actuarial world as the duration for which these unfunded liabilities ought to be addressed. So when we achieved a contribution increase effective with the current fiscal year, the goal was to address that unfunded liability within that 30-year time frame. As a result of enhanced or higher than anticipated investment earnings, we may very well be able to address that unfunded liability more quickly. So I think we're down now to about a 28-year time frame. But that's volatile because a period of down and sustained markets could result in an increase. But we hope to never see it increase beyond that 30. And we're going to be working diligently to get it down to zero, actually, in that 30-year time frame.
Well, you've got a plan, Tom. That's what's important.
Indeed, we do.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it so much.
Thomas Williams is the executive director of the Hawaii Employment Retirement System, and you can find his link to a talk outlining the state of the pension fund on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
First, the diagnosis, anorexia nervosa, then intensive treatment, now the daily struggle of recovery.
Even when I'm doing better, it's like there's chained to my ankle a dead body, and it's there all the time.
For our series Been There, two women compare notes on fighting an eating disorder, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 p.m., following Fresh Air.
This is The Conversation on statewide member support at Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, uncertainty over immigration and its effect on COFA migrants. But first, your quiz. We've got elective officials on the brain today in today's backyard quiz. We'll focus on a historical office holder from territorial days. Before Hawaii became a state, territorial governors were appointed by the president, not elected by residents. And as often the case with high-level appointments, presidents drew from a small circle of experienced bureaucrats to fill different offices over the years. This is very much the case in Hawaii, where several gubernatorial appointees held other government offices representing Hawaii. In this case, Dwight Eisenhower asked this former territorial governor to temporarily come out of retirement and serve as the governor of another U.S. territory after leaving office in Hawaii. So for today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this gubernatorial appointee and the name of the U.S. territory in which he held office? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Recent years have seen immigration issues politicized as never before, and immigrants to the U.S. from around the world have seen their presence in this country challenged and the laws that permitted their presence here questioned. That uncertainty has affected Hawaii's Micronesian community, and two people who deal with immigration issues on a regular basis are here with us in our studio. Tatiana Johnson, Managing Attorney of the Hawaii Immigrant Justice Center at Legal Aid, and Joanna Loyak, Outreach Specialist for the Hawaii Immigrant Justice Center. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
First, Tatiana, let me start with you because we want to sort of clarify the issue of so-called COFA migrants here under the Compact of Free Association. Could you kind of set the stage for that?
Sure. So COFA refers to three nations in particular who have treaties with the United States. That's the Republic of the Marshall Islands, from which Joanne comes, the Federated States of Micronesia, and the Republic of Palau. And the U.S. has had in the last 100 years a long history with these nations. After World War II, there was military involvement as the U.S. became entrusted with these then territories. The U.S. did extensive nuclear testing in these territories. In about the late 70s, negotiations happened so that they would become independent island nations. And in the 80s, there was negotiations that they would have treaties with the United States. So that's where we get the Compact of Free Association. That was in 86.
Right.
They were renewed in 2003, and they'll be it'll be up for renewal again in 2023. And the impact most specifically for Hawaii is that these treaties with the United States allow citizens from these nations to live and work in the U.S.
So they're here with a protected status, essentially. They're not technically immigrants, I think, is what you were saying earlier.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you look at immigration law, citizens from these compact nations are considered non-immigrants versus what we think of, like, for lawful permanent residents, green card holders, which would be considered immigrants under the law.
Yeah.
And that makes a big difference in terms of what benefits and rights they have under federal and state laws.
And Joanne, you're from the Marshall Islands, and you work with people who are here from the Marshall Islands, and they come to you for help getting in touch with various government agencies. Yeah, what kind of things do they ask you about?
Hi. Yes, they ask a lot of questions.
Uh-huh.
Like, for example, how to get benefits, medical insurance, for example, because most of these people, they come here sick, and that's why they're here to seek medical assistance.
How large a community is there out in Hawaii, Joanne?
It's a large community. Just the Marshallese themselves, I think in 2011, there were 7,000, if I'm correct.
What kind of medical issues do they talk to you about?
Well, most of these people are in dialysis, for example, so they would need assistance getting insurance, medical insurance.
Yeah.
And that's where we connect them to. We have kukuas in Legal Aid.
Uh-huh.
These are people that register them for, and these are people that speak their language. We have Micronesians, like people from Point Bay to Kauai, and of course, Marshallese.
Mm-hmm. Tatiana, these are people a long way from home in a pretty unfamiliar setting. Do you see, how does that play out in what you see?
Yes, I mean, I think for like any new immigrant to the U.S., navigating a totally different culture, a totally different government system is challenging. So a lot of what we do at the Hawaii Immigrant Justice Center is help our COFA brothers and sisters navigate these systems. So
yeah.
Like, for instance, Joanne does a lot of outreach and education with respect to language access. Because if you think about it, you come here, you're sick, you're on dialysis, you're in a completely foreign place, and you don't speak the language, right? So it's about educating newer immigrants that they have rights. For instance, state federal governments and anyone receiving those funds have to provide meaningful language access. So like if you go to the doctor, there has to be a Marshallese interpreter. If you go to DHS to apply for medical insurance, they need to provide you an interpreter. So these are really important things for our compact brothers and sisters living here.
Is it a pretty concentrated community in Honolulu or scattered around around the islands? Where is everybody?
Yes, I would say in Oahu, throughout the island. I think on the neighbor islands, it's more rural, living in rural communities, which even further kind of alienates this population from receiving services and having meaningful access to services. But and even on Oahu, I think large populations live in kind of historically immigrant communities like Waipahu and Kalihi.
Mm-hmm. Joanne, where you grew up, people look out for each other, right?
Yes.
Families look out for each other, families and friends.
Yes, it's a very close-knitted community, and I think it happens in all the Kofa Nation as well as here in Hawaii.
And it does, that gets brought to, people bring that to Hawaii.
Yes, people take care of each other. Families live together, and that's another challenge.
How is that?
Depending on each other.
Challenge how, Joanne?
Well, for instance, a family of, I guess, more than four would be like staying together. Like when I say four, that means four families all together. Like maybe their mother and their dad, and then there is their children, and then their children married, and then their children.
They might all be under the same roof?
Under the same roof, and maybe only one person is working for the family. So that person has to work at the same time, take care of mom and dad, trying to take mom and dad to the hospital or other appointments that they need to go to.
Are many of them have difficulty with language, you know, relatively little English speaking?
Yes, many of the people that come here have English is their second language.
Right.
Because back home, everybody speaks their own language. They speak Marshallese.
And, of course, if your English is limited, then you get into what Tatiana was describing, the whole need to find a translator.
Yes, we were just discussing that. I was telling Tatiana that already they are at disadvantage because of language barriers. And then they come here, and they don't know how to navigate the systems. And then there's all these layers of issues that they have to deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
Like earlier when I was coming here, I got lost, and I was freaking out. And, you know, I can read signs, and I can, you know, I understand English. I can ask people around.
Right.
I'm just imagining when people come here, and they don't have all those,
yeah,
know, they can't access to all
how
of
how much
that.
More difficult it would have
mm-hmm.
been, right?
Yes.
So, Tatiana, it sounds as if translation services are essential in so many areas here.
Yes, definitely. I think the state is improving on that. So we've seen a lot of improvement, for instance, with the Department of Human Services. They have an Office of Language Access. I've seen a lot of improvement in the judiciary, so going to court, making sure that there's interpreters in the courtroom. But I still see very problematic areas like with the police, not providing interpreters. So we assist many domestic violence victims. So if you can imagine, if you're in an abusive relationship, you call the police, it's already a very dangerous situation. You don't understand what's going on. You don't know that you have rights. And there's no interpreter provided. It's a very, very frightening situation to be in. So while there have been tremendous leaps in the last decade here in the state, there's still some areas that are very, very concerning.
What's your wish list for areas of improvement?
Well, the one I just mentioned, you know, with
law enforcement,
vulnerable populations like our kupuna, you know, like Joanne was talking about, the Marshall Islands has hospitals, but they can't provide dialysis. So if you need dialysis, you have to come to the state, making sure that, you know, if someone's here, that they're provided for. We have decreasing affordable housing in the state. So that's not unique to COFA, but it certainly impacts them.
The whole, let's get back to that sort of sense of a climate of uncertainty regarding immigrant populations. What you're describing to me, Tatiana, is that the COFA agreement is in place until, what, 2023?
Yes.
So COFA migrants should have nothing to worry about.
Well, no. I mean, like any immigrant group or anybody subject to a treaty, right, it's going to be dependent upon the United States negotiating with foreign powers. I think right now there's not the same fear as there is with what we're seeing with the Muslim ban, but that doesn't mean that the perception isn't there, that
right.
There's not that fear. And there's also, we see with both administrations, the Obama and the Trump, an increase in deportation, right? That impacts immigrant communities, whether you're from the Marshall Islands or a lawful permanent resident. That fear is still there, right? That perception.
Do you see that, Joanne?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I'm just smiling because a couple months back when the new president came into office, there was a big chaos in the community. Everybody was telling each other that Donald Trump is going to send everybody back home. So
really?
People were very scared and they were afraid. We have to tell them, calm down. No, it's not happening right now. But
people,
who knows?
It's if people think it, they're going to be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I was wondering about. Was mm-hmm. sort of the reality is often one thing. The perception is
yes.
is sometimes what counts. Is
yeah,
kind of what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to both of you for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Sure.
Thank you.
Tatiana Johnson is the managing attorney of the Hawaii Immigrant Justice Center at Legal Aid, and her focus in areas include violence against women, immigration, and public benefits. Joanna Loyak is an outreach specialist for the Hawaii Immigrant Justice Center at Legal Aid. Joanna is from the Marshall Islands and speaks Marshallese. She provides outreach and education to immigrant victims of domestic violence, especially to immigrants from the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and Palau.
Hi, I'm Zach Diana from Dreamhouse Eva Beach Charter School. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Some 1,600 Hawaii prison inmates are being held at the Saguaro Correctional Center, a for-profit enterprise in Eloy, Arizona, and they're about to have company. 200 of the most violent and disruptive inmates from Nevada prisons are about to be shipped to that facility. The state of Hawaii has a long-standing relationship with the company that operates the prison, and its past history raises some concern, as Louis Kanea tells us in today's reality check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Louis.
Good morning.
My first reaction to this was, what could go wrong? And something could go wrong, couldn't it?
Yeah, potentially, yes. But, the Department of Public Safety here tells me that they are going to be separated, those two inmates from the Hawaii and Nevada. So we'll see. But they haven't given us any detail as to what they're going to do to separate those two population of inmates in the common areas, places like the recreational yards, the dining halls, and other areas. My understanding is that they don't necessarily have the separate independent facilities, or at least those areas specifically for the Nevada inmates. So, they obviously have to juggle those places, and we have no idea what's going to happen to that.
These are inmates that Nevada wanted nothing to do with, right? These are the worst of the worst, it sounds like.
So they are basically facing the same issue that we are facing, which is the dire shortage of beds, prison beds. And they basically reached the point where they just have to ship a whole bunch of people. Now, they were basically saying that if they are going to send somebody out of state, then, well, we better just send out the bad ones we don't want to deal with.
Yeah.
Which is fine for them, I suppose. But for us, the Hawaii inmates who are sitting at the Saguaro, potential would be, at least there's a potential for the danger there.
As you said, they've made promises about keeping them separate, but what you're telling me is that they can't keep them separate all the time.
Right. Well, I don't know for sure how they're going to manage it, and they are declining to provide any details of how they're managing to do that. In the past, though, we've had, we've had a relationship with private companies to house our inmates all the way going back to 1995. And, for example, 1999, the company, the Core Civic, which is the company that we are contracting with,
right.
They had a whole bunch of inmates from us in a facility in Oklahoma. And they also had Indiana inmates there. And two dozen prisoners there, basically began fighting there. That was one of the good example of what could go wrong in a situation like this.
One of the concerns that's always raised about for-profit prison facilities is that they have, obviously as a profit-making enterprise, they have an incentive to keep costs down, right?
Right. That's always been the sort of the bigger picture debate that we've had. And, the private prison obviously has different incentives than that we do, except that we don't have any time really for, method to really bring them back and not deal with the private companies just because we don't have any beds here. So, I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. We are talking about OCCC being replaced, but that's a jail facility, so that's not a place for the prison inmates. And even if they do make the new facility in the near future, they're just going to replace the OCCC or what it is, and there won't be any more capacity to bring people back. So that's kind of the issue here.
So this is what we've got for the moment anyway. Thanks very much, Louis, for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Louis Kanea. A team of young scientists from Hawaii is entering an international competition whose entrants are asked to pluck water from thin air. The competition for the Water Abundance X Prize is an effort to harness innovation and apply it to one of the world's most critical problems before it's too late. We spoke with ZJ Lin, the leader of Hawaii's Team Firefly, about the scope of the problem.
The problem is water scarcity. It's not just the lack of clean drinking water. It's pretty much the lack of clean drinking water. There's plenty of water on the planet, but over time, man-made pollution has made pretty much all the rivers in the world unsafe to drink, such as the river in Shanghai. It's so contaminated that, based on the city consensus, only 3% of the city's water supply in the surface is drinkable. The rest is... it can't even sustain life.
How does a city that size get around that problem?
They actually don't. So what they're doing now is they're starting to build desalination plants and ship water from miles away to feed the people.
This is a sign of a problem that's already passed critical mass, hasn't it?
Yeah. Back a couple years ago, we saw a case where an entire river in China was turned red from chemicals from a factory.
You do have to wonder at what point problems like that become irreversible, don't you?
Exactly. I mean, a lot of the rivers, they're so contaminated, like the Ganga River in India.
Uh-huh.
It's so contaminated beyond measures. Fish don't survive in that water. Heck, we had the same similar problem here in Hawaii when the Alawai Canal was ran over with sewage.
Right.
I mean, people don't even step into the water. If there was a case where the water itself caused someone to have a skin-eating bacteria from an injury, we remember that, Imagine a river with constant supply of pig carcasses thrown into it and feces poured in daily. And that's happening in China, India, and Jordan, everywhere in the world. Where there's river and people, there's going to be contamination, and we have to do something about that right now.
What kind of water contamination issues does Hawaii face?
Currently, right now, with all the construction going on, we have industrial runoff. Other than industrial runoff would be our sewage problem, and that's pretty much what Hawaii has, since we don't have a lot of industry here. But we also have the problem with pesticides. When they spray pesticides in the plants and the soil, it blows away into the water supply, or it seeps into the groundwater supply.
Is it measurably to be found in the aquifer today?
I can't say for sure. I've actually worked on a project to design sensors to measure the water supply in the aquifers. So we're still doing studies on that.
Do we not know the answer to that question? Does somebody know the answer to that
question? Someone does. I can't personally say for sure. But based on where we get our water from, Hawaii pretty much gets all our water from the aquifers, and they're a draining supply. And in about 100 years, there might not even be aquifers around because of all the urbanization. So we have a lot of paved roads, and when it rains, that water gets washed away into the ocean instead of seeping into the ground supply. So, yeah, there's a lot of problem with the water situation in Hawaii, especially if we're increasing our population demand. I mean, if you've seen Kaka'ako, there's a lot of buildings going up.
Mm-hmm.
But who's ever done the math to see if every one of those units were filled, do we have enough water to sustain everyone living on the island? I mean, everyone's worried about the electricity. We're worried about traffic. But who's really talking about the water? I mean, it's a really important issue that no one ever talks about, because in their minds, they think that water is just everywhere. But it really isn't. We live in a society where the government makes sure that we have water. In California, there's a water problem going on, but we're able to ship water from far away from other reservoirs to the city. In places like India, they can't do that. They would have to truck water from other countries over or go to war and fight for water.
That's where innovation comes in, yeah?
Exactly.
CJ Lin and his team Firefly Cohorts are one of 98 teams from 24 countries invited to take part in the Water Abundance XPRIZE competition. And we talked with CJ about the challenges his team faces.
The XPRIZE competition is a $1.5 million prize purse given to a team that can design a device that can harvest 2,000 liters of water from the atmosphere per day with a operating cost of less than 2 cents per liter. And it has to work everywhere in the world because there's people everywhere in the world.
So what kind of challenges does that pose for you and your partner?
The biggest challenge right now is to be able to meet the goal while not consuming way too much energy. So we're trying to solve water scarcity, and it's irresponsible to make a machine that contributes to another problem, which is greenhouse emissions. So we have to use 100% renewable energy.
Mm-hmm. You can't just fire up a bunch of gas turbines.
Exactly. Then we make more problems by solving one problem.
Right, right. Well, of which history has shown, has been known to happen, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So this is a kind of an innovative approach, and you guys innovated in response to it. What did you come up with?
So we came up with a method of using special surfaces that really likes water and surfaces that really don't like water.
Hydrophilic and hydrophobic, as you
exactly.
described it.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And we run a lot of air through it with a turbine fan, which is like a jet.
Right.
And what's cool about the fan is it's very efficient. We can run a whole lot of air through our system without using a lot of energy. And to get a lot of water from air, you mm-hmm. need a lot of air with yeah. a lot of water in it. So as the air goes through our system, water gets attracted to the super hydrophilic, so the part that really likes water,
mm-hmm.
and it beads up and drips down to the part that really doesn't like water, and that part just ejects the water out of the system, so it frees up more space for condensation to form.
Mm-hmm. Have you been able to meet that goal of, what was it, 2,000 liters?
2,000 liters a day. We haven't tested the full large scale, but we did a lot of small scale experiments to prove our theories.
And you're encouraged?
Oh yeah. All our tests have shown positive results. If they were bad, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at a diagram. What is describe for me what your gizmo looks like. How big is it?
It looks like a tower that's about the size of a regular average adult, about 6 feet tall.
Okay.
Or 5.5 feet 8 inches.
And you just need air, right?
Yep.
You just pump air through it really fast.
And cool that air really efficiently.
Cool it.
So
that makes that gets the water out more efficiently?
Yeah, so temperature drop is how water from gas turns to liquid. That's one method. And another one would be pressure, but that takes way too much energy and it's just inefficient in general, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But it's modeled off of the actual, like, the atmosphere. When the air gets cold, it holds less water. So if there's a lot of water in the warm air and temperature drops, that water has to go somewhere. So it rains.
You're a rainmaker.
Exactly. We're the rainmakers. Yeah.
Without even having to cast a spell, yeah?
Well, it's called science.
Yeah.
Science is a spell.
Okay, so I'm the contest now, and I'm posing challenges to, you know, how does this thing work? And the first challenge I would think of was, how's it going to work in different climates? How's it going to work in the Arctic? How's it going to work in the Gobi Desert?
So if you were in the Arctic, you wouldn't need this machine.
Okay.
There'd be snow.
Good point, yeah.
But in the, the Gobi Desert, you have to have at least some moisture in the air, and there's always a little bit of moisture in the air because the atmosphere likes to reach equilibrium somewhere, somehow. It's going to mix from other areas and blows over.
Mm-hmm.
But the trick is to start the condensation. Since it's always so hot in the desert, the relative humidity will show up very low, but there's still water content in the air. So if you provide a cooling source, you could induce or you can force rain to happen.
Okay, so you're in the desert and you add a cooling source to your gizmo.
Yeah.
What powers the cooling source?
Solar panels are...
Guess you got sunshine in the desert.
Yeah, if you have sunshine in the desert and you have wind at night, so you can use a combination of solar panels and wind turbines.
Well, let me just postulate that there's a place somewhere in the world where the air is dry and the wind is scarce and it isn't that sunny.
Oh, yeah, of course.
There got to be such places, right?
Like Texas. Texas is something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are you going to hit your 2,000-liter mark in the most hostile climate on Earth?
Well,
it has to pass that test, right?
Yeah, it does. But if we go up on a higher altitude, there's a band of moisture. So you know how you see clouds in the sky?
Uh-huh.
If there's cloud, there's water. So the trick is to finding the right altitude with that water source. Even there's clouds in the desert, so.
So you could go high up over the Sahara Desert, the Mojave Desert,
exactly.
And find moisture somewhere.
Yep, there's always moisture somewhere on this planet.
Is that factored into the design?
That was considered, but since since we have so little time, we put that on the back burner, but we'll look into that in the future.
But you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
This is the kind of, you know, these are the kind of tests you're going to have to pass.
So previously we've done tests with a weather balloon,
right,
where we went up at a different altitude to test or to measure the humidity in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that when you go higher, humidity changes to a certain point. There's a small region in the sky where humidity is close to 90 to 100%.
And you can set it up to measure that and kind of pause your weather balloon at that altitude?
Exactly. But since it was too expensive for us to continue experiments on, we had to stop doing that.
But that's kind of the fun of, you know, doing something like this project, right?
Oh, you know. We
meeting challenges and overcoming hurdles like that.
Yeah, that was really fun. We actually launched a weather balloon in the middle of a park, and everyone was looking at us like we're some crazy scientists, but it was amazing.
Well, you know, they probably looked at Orville and Wilbur Wright the same way, right?
Oh, exactly. I mean, I've been told that what we're doing is very, very out of this world, mainly because we're trying to make water from thin air.
ZJ Lin is the leader of Team Firefly, competing in the Water Abundance XPRIZE competition. The competition has challenged almost 100 teams from 25 countries to create potable water out of thin air in an environmentally sustainable manner. You can find details about Team Firefly and the XPRIZE competition on today's edition of the Conversation podcast.
Aloha mai kākou. This is Ku'uipo Kumukahi, Manager of Hawaiian Culture and Community Relations at the Hyatt Regency Waikiki, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
For today's quiz, we're taking a look back at the politics of territorial days. Specifically, we're delving into the resume of a Hawaii territorial governor. Governors in the territorial days were appointed by the president, not elected. That being the case, it comes at no surprise to learn there was some overlap among the different U.S. territories. The man we asked you to identify today was born in Honolulu in 1887. His grandfather was an American missionary, cabinet minister to Kamehameha III, co-founder of Punahou School. He was appointed governor of Hawaii by Herbert Hoover in 1929, serving in that post for 5 years. After completing his appointment as governor of Hawaii, our man served as the superintendent in residence of the colony at Kalaupapa, Molokai. In 1953, already into his 70s, Lawrence Judd was temporarily brought out of retirement by President Dwight Eisenhower to serve as the governor of American Samoa. Nobody got that today, but that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, this is Jim Moffat. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
There's always a lot going on around our islands, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, we're being urged to clean up our room, Derek.
Mm-hmm, yes, rearrange objects in your bedroom.
Uh-huh.
To be more specific, Claire Engelbert is a feng shui expert, and he says the bed is the most important object in your home. Yeah.
No argument there.
Yes, me too, yes. He'll talk about various details such as color, texture, lighting, and artwork that help a bedroom support sound sleep, which everyone wants. This is happening at 5:30 in the Kealakekua Public Library tomorrow. And it's free, yes.
And here's an animator who worked on Moana and Frozen talking about his work.
Yes, his name is Renato Dos Anjos. And he's worked, besides on those films, on Zootopia, Wreck-It Ralph, Bolt, Jimmy Neutron, Boy Genius, and more. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with these films that I just mentioned. Dos Anjos will talk about his 30-year career in animation and what it takes to stay inspired and continue to learn as an artist. It's happening tomorrow from 6 to 8 p.m. at Kapi'olani Community College, Ohia 118, and it's free.
That should attract a lot of interest then.
Oh, yes.
Here's a chance to explore Kona through its hands-on history program this month.
The Kona Coffee Living History Farm in Captain Cook is presenting this program. It's free with admission to the farm. The Kona Historical Society wants to preserve the history behind Kona's coffee industry and also its pioneers. And tomorrow's activity is called Backyard Groceries, Sustainability in the Kitchen Garden. It's happening from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the farm in Captain Cook. For more information on this program that lasts throughout November, just go to our website.
Sounds good, Derek. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at some events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll look at the results of a worldwide coral bleaching study. You can tell us what you think about anything you heard on the program by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you can find out more information about today's topics, along with links to our daily podcast. I'm Chris Vanderkoek. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.